Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on Indiana House Speaker Brian Bosma, former Gary Schools Corporation Superintendent Cheryl Pruitt faces felony charges, and Chris Nolte has a conversation about Domestic Violence Awareness Month. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Senator Joe Donnelly is bringing in help in his effort to run up the vote in the Democratic stronghold of Northwest Indiana. According to the Associated Press, Vice President Joe Biden, who has blue-collar appeal and presidential ambitions, will campaign with Donnelly Friday in Hammond in this heavily industrial corner of the state. But Biden won't be the only vice president paying a visit to the state. Vice President Mike Pence will be appearing at a fundraiser dinner in Indianapolis around the same time to rev up support for Donnelly's rival, Republican businessman Mike Braun. Indiana has been reliably red state in recent years, but the two are locked in a close race that could determine which party controls the Senate. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A woman alleges that when she was an Indiana legislative intern in 1992, she performed oral sex on a married Republican lawmaker who has since become the Speaker of the House of Representatives. The former Democratic intern told the Indy Star that the sexual act with Brian Bosma was consensual, but that she felt pressured into it. Bosma at the time was the Republican minority in the House. Bosma, who first became Indiana House Speaker in 2004, issued a statement Wednesday denying the woman's claim and saying he's hired attorney Linda Pence to protect his reputation. Pence is not related to Vice President Mike Pence, Indiana's former governor. The Indy Star also reported that Bosma paid Pence's law firm more than $40,000 in campaign funds this year, in part to gather unflattering information about the former intern, and that the woman's family members said Pence threatened to reveal her name and unfavorable information about her if the account became public. Linda Pence said in a written statement to the Indy Star that she ran a professional investigation and, quote, witnesses sources were not threatened or harassed. Bosma played a leading role in investigating allegations that Republican Attorney General Curtis Hill inappropriately touched a lawmaker and several legislative staffers earlier this year. Bosma is among the state GOP leaders who have called on Hill to resign. A law passed by the General Assembly this year requires Bosma and other legislative leaders to implement a new sexual harassment policy for lawmakers by November 20th. Lawmakers currently are not subject to a sexual harassment policy. Bosma initially questioned the need for the new law, but Democrats forced the issue and the General Assembly approved it. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Governor Eric Holcomb says he won't comment on allegations of intimidation and adultery leveled against House Speaker Brian Bosma. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the accusations from a former House Democratic intern appeared in an Indianapolis Star story Wednesday.
Candy Green says she had a sexual encounter with Brian Bosma in 1992, and she claims an attorney hired by Bosma this year harassed her friends and family in an effort to intimidate and discredit her. Bosma denies both accusations. Governor Eric Holcomb won't call for any investigation, and he says he won't comment without a, quote, official report of the allegations.
An actual report pursued by either of the parties that were involved. Not just a story based on discussions from years ago.
Holcomb did call for an Inspector General investigation into sexual misconduct allegations against Attorney General Curtis Hill earlier this year, but the IG has no authority over the legislature. That's the purview of the House Ethics Committee, and Democrats say Holcomb could have urged it to take up the issue. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Gary native George Taliaferro sadly passed away earlier this week. Taliaferro was the first black drafted by an NFL team in 1949. WBEZ's Michael Puente has more.
In 1949, the Chicago Bears became the first NFL team to draft a black player in George Taliaferro. But Taliaferro didn't play for the Bears since he had already committed to play for the Los Angeles Dons of the All-American Football Conference. Before then, he was a star running back at Indiana University. Ramir Williams heads a student organization at IU, recently named after Taliaferro.
So it's kind of built on the legacy that he had while he was here and the work that he did diversifying and desegregating the school from when he was here.
Taliaferro eventually played for several NFL teams. He was 91 when he died in Mason, Ohio on Monday. I'm Michael Puente.
George Taliaferro is survived by his wife of 67 years, Viola, and their two daughters. You're listening to Lakeshore
Gary
Update
Chicago's with
International
D.
Airport's first international flight cleared customs Sunday, 3 days after a new U.S. Customs and Border Protection facility opened for business. Passengers and crew on board a flight from Denmark were greeted by airport and customs officials. According to airport officials, the visitors cleared customs less than 30 minutes after landing. The customs facility allows general aviation flights to land at Gary without having to stop at another airport to clear customs. The airport's two fixed-base operators, which provide maintenance, fueling, hangar space, and hospitality to airport users, said the customs facility will help them attract new business. The customs office is housed in a building that's also home to the airport's fire and rescue crews. The customs facility was remodeled at the cost of about $1 million this year. The facility operates on an on-call basis with 72 hours notice to U.S. Customs and Border Protection officials required before a plane lands. A maximum of 20 individuals per airplane will be allowed to clear customs.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Former Gary Schools Corporation Superintendent Cheryl Pruitt's new job may be in question just days after the Lake County prosecutors filed felony theft and official misconduct charges. The Post-Tribune reports the Chicago Virtual Charter Schools Board met for 30 minutes in a closed session on Wednesday night to discuss two issues, including a personnel matter. Pruitt has worked as CEO of Chicago Virtual Schools in Chicago since April. The former school superintendent has been charged with double billing the district for about $1,200 in expenses. She resigned as superintendent in February after a state-appointed emergency manager took over the district as it faced more than $100 million in debt. The criminal charges allege Pruitt was reimbursed about $1,500 for expenses to a 2016 education conference in Los Angeles, but then submitted many of those same expenses a second time for a $1,200 payment. Court documents say Pruitt told an investigator the double billing wasn't done intentionally. Pruitt's initial appearance in Lake Superior Court is scheduled for October 22nd. Online court records show her lawyers are Scott King and Russell Brown Jr.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An Illinois judge is rebuffing claims that a youth football coach brandished a gun during a fight with parents, and he agreed to set lower bonds for both men arrested during the melee. 43-year-old Terrence Morris of Valparaiso and 39-year-old Devorah Clark of Maryville are facing felony charges stemming from the Saturday fight in Rockford. They were coaches for the Calumet City Thunderbolts when a post-game fight broke out with the Rockford Renegades coach and parents. The Rockford Register Star reports three witnesses told police they saw Clark with a gun, but Judge Francis Martinez said during a hearing Tuesday that the weapon was found in Clark's car. A prosecutor sought $50,000 bonds for both men.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A Minnesota fugitive who taunted authorities on social media by vowing she'd never be caught has been arrested in Northwest Indiana. 31-year-old Taisha Monique Moore was taken into custody Monday in Michigan City by members of the Twin Cities apprehension team. She was wanted on 16 outstanding warrants, including felony theft and domestic assault, all from Minnesota. She's being held in Michigan City awaiting extradition to Minnesota. Stu Peters is the lead investigator for the Twin Cities apprehension team. He says multiple residences in Minnesota, North Dakota, and Indiana were searched for more. Michigan City Police say a local informant helped in the arrest.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Debate Commission received more questions about climate change for Monday night's Senate debate than any other topic. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel delves into what this might say about Indiana voters.
Nearly 15% of all Senate debate questions contain the phrase climate change. Indiana Debate Commission President Jerry Linowska says that's even more than the word marijuana, a popular subject in debates. The commission doesn't have hard data on past debate topics, but anecdotally, Linowska says climate change seems to be on people's minds more this election cycle.
I think it certainly reflects that there's a growing sense of urgency among some subset of voters out there who really want to see this issue addressed.
Linowska says most of the people who asked about climate change were from university communities and tended to vote Democratic or independent, though some of those independents say they often vote Republican. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The discovery of a new drug compound could lead to non-opioid pain medication. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on the first steps to develop this potential treatment.
Purdue University researchers reached to identify this compound for years. Associate Dean Val Watts says the discovery was made using animal models and it inhibits a certain enzyme.
Adenylyl cyclase type 1, or AC1, we call it for short. These animals did not experience various forms of chronic and inflammatory pain.
The enzyme AC1 organizes biological messages involved in the communication of pain. Watts says this is only the first step towards medicine that could be used by humans. Federal legislation passed this month aims to boost research for non-opioid pain treatment alternatives. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Even though the state is projected to need to fill a million jobs in the next decade, a recent report shows the state entering an era where Hoosier labor force growth will slow to almost zero. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the state could be poised to see just 2% of the labor force growth it saw in the second half of the 20th century.
Indiana University researchers say the growth in the number of Indiana workers will slow to a tiny fraction of its current pace within a couple decades. Between 2020 and 2050, the research estimates the labor force in Indiana will add only 34,000 jobs total. That's in contrast to about 280,000 new employees per decade from 1950 to 2010. Indiana Business Research Center Deputy Director Carol Rogers says businesses have to be competitive to fill jobs.
It's our slow population growth right now, as well as the really terrific job market, which makes people very mobile.
Rogers says it could also mean companies will be more reliant on automation to address a tight labor market. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Ben Carson, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, was the keynote speaker at the Indiana Civil Rights Fair Housing Law and Policy Conference Wednesday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports Carson focused on making changes at the local level.
During an audience-submitted Q&A session, Carson said public-private initiatives at the local level are essential to improving public assistance.
We need to be doing things that have nothing to do with Democrats or Republicans, but have to do with elevating our population.
Carson also highlighted his department's work on his Envision Centers program. That program gathers government, nonprofit, and faith-based resources in one place within a community for people in public housing. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
More organizations have adopted Adverse Childhood Experience, or ACE scores, to assess the health impact of childhood trauma. Some of these experiences are more common for children in Indiana than other states, including having a parent in prison and witnessing violence. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan sat down with the president of the Indiana Youth Institute, Tammy Silverman, to talk about how ACE scores inform care.
Why did you think it was important to highlight this issue?
Well, we're hearing more, particularly from educators, saying we know that kids in their classrooms are being impacted, particularly by parents that are suffering with substance use disorders, mental health, and they don't know how to really respond to those kids. And so an ACE score helps you understand for a child what experiences have they gone through.
You took a look at these ACE scores and compared Indiana with the rest of the nation and why Indiana children might be dealing with these at higher levels.
The ones that we were most concerned about when we did this analysis was the number of children who had experienced a parental death, that had a parent who'd served time in jail, that was living with someone that had a problem with drugs or alcohol and or mental health, and that had witnessed neighborhood violence or domestic violence. And many kids experience one or two of those, right? But it's when you start to combine three or four or five, as they start to multiply, that we see that having a longer impact on an immediate child as well as their long-term health.
The trauma that a child has gone through during a developmental stage, do you think that there's a growing awareness about the real life long-term impact of that?
Absolutely. And thankfully, we're hearing much more about trauma-informed care and how do we best respond and how do we take into account the whole child and understanding social emotional needs of kids. And they're all intertwined, right? It's really saying that if we want our kids to succeed academically, if we want them to be engaged citizens, how do we prepare them for that?
Some children in Indiana may be impacted more than other children.
Absolutely. And that has to do, some of it has to do with responses, right? So if you are dealing with a substance use disorder or mental health, if you can't access care for that, that is going to have a much longer impact. That's going to increase the severity of that experience for that child when they're witnessing it with their parents. And so again, I think understanding that a child's experience is greatly informed by the environment they live in.
We're looking at, you know, chronic long-term conditions that some children might be experiencing.
Right. And I think that was one of the real aha moments of the Adverse Childhood Experience Study when it first came out. And it's been out for a long time, 20 years, right? It's not new, but we're still just starting to incorporate it into our daily practice. Is the reality that these kids that have a cumulative effect are more likely to have heart attacks. They're more likely to abuse drugs themselves as they grow older. They're more likely to have some of those chronic health conditions, diabetes. They're more apt to have a stroke. Years and years and years later. And you think about it, when you also have those positive childhood experiences on the flip side, right? So when you have a mentor who invests and pours time and energy into you, when you have that special teacher, when you have a great school environment, that also sets you up and that also impacts you for the rest of your life.
So what can we do? What can schools, organizations, anyone do to really impact this?
You can understand what some of those indicators are. And again, some of them are very acute, right? So if you know that a child has been removed from their home because of an addiction issue in that home, that seems like a high attention, high intensity issue, and it is. Simultaneously, parent divorce is also one of these signs. So when you know of a child that's in your family or in your friend group or that's in your extended faith community or school community, when they're dealing with one of these issues, lean into them.
Thank you so much for chatting today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
More cases of human trafficking are being identified across the country each year, including in Indiana. Hospitals and medical professionals can play a large role in tackling the issue, but there are a number of challenges. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright reports, experts are implementing what they say is an easier, more efficient way to get healthcare workers the training they need.
There's a small room tucked in an inconspicuous spot here at Community Health East. A lot of people won't ever know it's there. It's called the Center of Hope. It's where Robin Huberta, a forensic nurse examiner, spends her days.
As a forensic nurse examiner, I care for victims of violence who come through the emergency department.
The cabinets contain sexual assault kits, blood tubes, there's a single chair with stirrups, and a couple cameras for documenting injuries. Huberta holds one with a bright blue light on the front of it. She flips off the room's overhead light.
This is to look for body secretions.
It's one of several procedures she may go through with people who've gone through traumatic experiences. Huberta says she does her best to be supportive. She sees all types of patients, including those who are victims of human trafficking.
We have a really unique role in healthcare that at some point these trafficked victims are going to need some type of medical treatment from a physician, whether it's to get antibiotics or to get on birth control or get pain medications or need a suture or something like that.
Huberta says simply recognizing a patient is being trafficked is difficult. They don't always know they're being trafficked, and their trafficker could be a significant other or even family member. But identifying cases is critical. According to the nonprofit anti-trafficking group Polaris Project, hospitals are the third point of access for those experiencing trafficking, right behind interaction with family and friends and law enforcement. So family nurse practitioner Christina Currier says getting healthcare workers the training they need is key.
It's not just physicians and nurses, it's security, it's the intake people, the triage people. Every point in that healthcare system, someone would be able to recognize if they're trained properly.
There are barriers in making that happen, though. Kate Kimmer works with the Indiana Coalition to End Sexual Assault. She says there's a lot that goes into training healthcare workers. It's not just teaching them to notice the red flags.
Okay, great. Like, you can tick a box, I identified somebody. But, like, seriously, then what? Who's your law enforcement partner? Who's your service providers you're referring to? How can you get that person help if they want it? Right? I mean, that's a kind of a bigger part of the conversation than just identifying.
And the next challenge is time. Healthcare providers are busy, so locking them into a comprehensive training seminar isn't easy. Members of the Indiana Protection for Abused and Trafficked Humans Task Force are launching a 90-minute webinar that hospitals can use to help their employees get the information they need and at a time that works for them.
That would be kind of that general call out that people could watch anytime and check their knowledge, make sure they know their knowledge, and would have access immediately to certain referral pathways and resources within the state of Indiana.
Depending on what your background in healthcare is.
A healthcare working group for IPATH gets a first look at that video, which includes information about trafficking laws and red flags. It also breaks down the stereotypical illustration of human trafficking.
Look at who your kids are going to school with. That's what human trafficking looks like. It looks just like you and I do.
Facilities across the state can use the webinar, then hospitals can request more training. An IPATH trainer would work with selected hospital staff, then those folks would take ownership of the training in their facility from then on out. Experts say it's a more sustainable and comprehensive way for hospitals to get on the same page. And Huberta thinks it's a step in the right direction.
We need to talk about how it impacts our community and how these people are coming through our hospitals and how we can make a huge difference with protecting them.
She says after receiving some training, community staff members identified more than a dozen trafficking victims in 2017. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with St. Jude's House Director of Development's Val Lay.
This is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, the month of October here across the nation, including Northwest Indiana. We're going to bring back the topic here and talking with the people involved the closest with this type of issue. The St. Jude House here in Northwest Indiana deals with helping people dealing with domestic violence of all types. And with us, Val Lay is the Director of Development for the St. Jude House. And Val, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for helping us draw attention to the issue of domestic violence.
One of the things that we have touched on in the past and we bring up every time during October, during this very special month, Domestic Violence Awareness Month, is to define for people that may not even know it can be definable what domestic or intimate partner abuse is. Val, will you define that for us, please?
Yes. Domestic violence is a pattern of coercive, controlling behavior in any relationship that is used to gain or maintain power and control over an intimate partner. The behaviors can include physical abuse, emotional or psychological abuse, sexual abuse, or financial abuse. It can be verbal or physical. This does include couples who are married, couples living together, or those who are just dating. It also can include parents, children, family members, and friends. In the U.S., there are 2 million injuries and 1,300 deaths every year caused by domestic violence.
I think it's important to note, and many people do not know this, that it doesn't have to be limited to women, that men can be victims as well. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. And St. Jude House can and does house men and their dependent children, as well as women and their dependent children.
Now, we know that, this, in turn, being pointed out, especially during Domestic Violence Awareness Month, makes it probably more significant. What is the significance of, having it in October?
Well, it is our national month for recognizing domestic violence. It's not a subject that is very easily discussed, but it affects everyone. For example, every minute, 20 people in the U.S. become victims of intimate partner violence. That's every minute. And one in three women and one in four men have experienced some form of physical violence by an intimate partner. Domestic Violence Awareness Month is meant to bring attention to the issue and to remind our community that there are still countless people, victims and survivors, their children and extended families, their coworkers, and their communities that are impacted by domestic violence. The silence about domestic violence must be broken if the generational cycle is going to be broken.
Now, how do you and the folks there at the St. Jude House help break that silence?
Well, I think it's important to note that St. Jude House was built to be a shelter, and unlike other domestic violence shelters, our address is published and publicized, including a large sign in the front yard. And that grew from the desire of the founders to have victims of domestic violence know where they could find help and to make the larger community aware of the impact of domestic violence.
How do you assist someone that may be a victim of domestic violence and getting help or needs the help? How can they do so?
They will, usually people will call our crisis line number first to get to answer some questions and get some advice from our client advisors and ensure that we do have the resources to help them. Our crisis line is 800-254-1286, and it is answered 24/7 year-round.
We're talking with Val Lay, who is the Director of Development for the St. Jude House. It's located in Crown Point. And especially note during this Domestic Violence Awareness Month that it's also not only does it involve emotion, but it also involves financial violence of some type. I'm kind of outlined that here earlier. But I know that, Val, that there's a very special program that helps with the people that need some financial empowerment, I guess, for like maybe a lack of a better way to put it. St. Jude House is working very closely with some local organizations and a very important national support as well, too. Tell us a little bit more about the Allstate Foundation's very special program, the Purple Purse Campaign.
The Purple Purse Campaign will be October 2nd through October 31st, and it is and has been sponsored by the Allstate Foundation for the last 15 years. One in four women experience domestic violence, and financial abuse is often why they just can't leave. So financial abuse includes things like limiting access to cash and credit cards, or drowning the victim in debt, or preventing them from keeping a job. So the Allstate Foundation Purple Purse is a program that's committed to shedding light on the on this invisible weapon that we hardly ever talk about.
Now, how does the St. Jude House help participate along with the Allstate Foundation in the Purple Purse campaign every year?
Well, there are two ways. We are extending our influence this year, but first we will we are participating in the Purple Purse campaign, and we do have an online Purple Purse 2018 challenge. It says St. Jude House 2018 Purple Purse Challenge. Mm-hmm. So donations can be given October 2nd through October 31st. However, we wanted to go a step farther than that, and we have had grant support from the Allstate Foundation, which allowed us to partner with Centaur Bank and Lakeshore Public Media for video production to create videos that will speak to the topics of budgeting, credit repair, and insurance. And we have these on our website, www.stjudehouse.org/financial empowerment. We also have a fourth video of a survivor of financial abuse, which can give people an answer to, am I being financially abused? How will I get out of it?
Financial abuse can happen to anyone. Not just females, it can be elderly, male, female. So my objective now in life is to help anyone I can that crosses my path. There's always a way out. We just have to find it. I was in my late 20s and married, and I was required to stay home, take care of the children. I tried having different part-time jobs, I was never able to keep up with the scheduling requirements because he would not come home and take care of the children. My oldest son called me, who was 8 years old, that his dad was hurting him. Everybody has a full mark with what they'll deal with. That was my full mark. I came home, the police were called. He was asked to leave the home because he told the police that he was going to go get his gun. I knew at that time I had to make a change. I had to change my habits, my lifestyle, and do something to better myself. I never wanted my children to be ashamed, and I wanted them to be proud of being raised by a single mom. People that knew me then and know me now, they're like, you're two different people. And that's why I want to talk to women, and I want to get my story out there, because there's so many people in the same situation. There were times where I wanted to call for help. The phone lines were cut on the outside of the house, so I couldn't call for help. I mean, the things I dealt with then compared to now, I just want to help people. That first step you take is hard. You're going to think you're making the biggest mistake of your life, that you've ruined everything that you've built up to that point. But when you really take a step back and look at it, you're doing the best thing for yourself. And if there's children involved, definitely for the children. Celebrate the little successes. My son wanted a stuffed animal. It was probably $20, $25 at that time. But saving up and buying only items we needed at that time and being very frugal with my money, let me celebrate those successes and make them happy. Not having to ask permission and going to the store, and if it was buying a treat for the kids or a toy for the kids or something for the house, each item, I don't care if it was through a thrift store, secondhand, it was mine, I paid for it, and I was proud of it. And having that moment just to be so proud of something you accomplished compared to where you had been, was just another stepping stone in the right direction. Them not having that pressure of the tension in the home, I have three amazing young men now. Not boys, but men. Would I change any of it? No.
Now, you mentioned the videos are available on your website right now. Is the chances there, or is it planned to expand being able to put these videos out so more people can see them here in Northwest Indiana?
There are worksheets that are associated with those videos. Mm-hmm. We plan to put them on YouTube, and we also have services for non-residential clients so that we can offer this training in-house to our residential clients and also to non-residential clients. Further in the future, we would like to offer it to offer the program at the public library or other such venues that the general public can attend.
Do you think that this would be a great opportunity to be able to expand this idea beyond just the month of October?
Oh, yes. We definitely see it as a part of our mission to bring awareness to the community about all the issues surrounding domestic violence. Well, St. Jude House has a community partners program which engages local businesses to support our mission and to become informed of the impact of domestic violence. Employed individuals spend the majority of their waking hours at work, and that's why employers are ideally suited to spot the symptoms of domestic violence and to intervene. Executives can promote a culture that includes domestic violence awareness and prevention and share information about domestic violence at the employee's orientation. It is powerful to understand the fact that domestic violence victims lose a total of 8 million days of paid work each year, and that is equal to 32,000 full-time jobs.
When you offer up not only the videos, the other information here during this very special month, and you have the opportunity to talk to people in person, help counsel them, and give them some assistance, do you get any reaction, any words of encouragement that come back to you there at the St. Jude House to continue doing what you're doing because it seems to have helped people?
Well, yes, we have a substantial support from the community at large in terms of inviting us to speak about these issues. We speak at churches and schools. Also, we work with law enforcement.
I guess, are you getting any reaction, good or maybe unfavorable reaction? Is it mostly good?
I think that the reaction from the community is always good. People may not have known that we were here or what we do, but when they find out, they understand that that is an important resource for them. And the best thing that we can do or that anyone can do to assist someone who's struggling with domestic violence is just starting a conversation with that person and speaking up. The right words are hard to find, but you can let that person know that they have your support and your concern for their safety and give them the St. Jude House Crisis Line number.
Well, Val, thank you very much for your information today, and we appreciate knowing that the St. Jude House is there here in Northwest Indiana to help those people who feel that they need to get out of the domestic problems that they're in, whether it's physical or whether it's financial. And this is the way to start, is to get hold of people. By the way, the website once again is www.stjudehouse.org. You can find out the information there about the programs in particular during Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Val, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about it today.
Thank you, Chris.